Right now, my maybe not super optimistic read is that our governance systems and kind of social systems are not set up well to ensure that these technologies are going to follow a development trajectory that is broadly in service of humanity.
Artificial intelligence has the power to transform so many aspects of society in so many places, but only a small number of companies in an even smaller number of countries hold the keys to AI's development.
And if you're the company that's building these technologies, what should you be aiming to try to do, recognizing that once it leaves your doors, you really don't have a huge amount of control as to whether somebody uses that coaching tool in a way that's possibly punitive to their staff? You kind of don't see it after a while.
So that small number of big companies have recognized AI's potential ethical shortcomings and formed the Partnership on AI, which came up with some guidelines.
Our hope is that with this tool, people at least who are excited about taking action on these issues and creating positive interactions between AI and workers and introducing AI into their workplaces and into their places of employment in ways that workers welcome and are excited to use, that this is a really helpful starting point for them. My name is Stephanie Bell, and I'm a senior research scientist with the Labor and Economy Program at the Partnership on AI. The Partnership on AI is a multi-stakeholder organization made up of industry, civil society, and academic participants interested in making sure that artificial intelligence creates broadly shared benefits in society. And my work has focused on both understanding impacts on workers and trying to find ways for companies that create AI products as well as companies that use those products to find ways to do so that are, you know, broadly beneficial to workers and create, widespread prosperity, rather than, I think, some of the more concerning paths that we've all probably seen about in the headlines.
So I was struck reading your research by how clearly you make the correlation between economic inequality and democracy, because we hear a lot about those two things independent of each other, but much of your work seems to be founded on that thesis that the two are very closely linked. Why is that theme so prominent in your work in artificial intelligence?
In the economic, in the literature on economic inequality and democracy, there's some interesting research taking a look at sort of where the causal effects or what the causal relationship looks like. We know empirically that relatively lower levels of economic inequality tend to be tied to higher measures of, you know, sort of different aspects of democracy and democratic robustness. I don't know that anybody to date has sorted out the direction of that relationship, whether it's that robust democratic institutions tend to produce more equitable economic outcomes, or whether more equitable economic conditions tend to produce more robust democratic outcomes. And you can see how that power relationship could flow in either direction. What that does mean, though, is that as we're looking at the potential impacts of technologies with the ability to possibly transform labor conditions and market conditions around the world, that we can't just be thinking about this in the context of what's going to happen to workers, what's going to happen to labor markets, are these going to be good jobs? There are real considerations that we need to take into account when it comes to, are these going to have broader social ramifications? And depending on sort of the directionality of that relationship I was just talking about, is there the potential for harms to economic equality to become self-reinforcing with harms to democracy as well?
So what is it about AI that you think undermines democracy?
So best as we can tell, the way that the current trajectory of artificial intelligence is on is one that is likely to displace a large number of tasks that people currently perform in the context of, you know, gainful waged employment, without creating a sufficient set of replacement tasks that are equally well compensated or, you know, equally present in a given economy. So recent research, for instance, led by Jerome Acemoglu of MIT and a number of his collaborators, has really focused on this sort of task displacement, task reinstatement dynamic, looking at kind of the more recent turn in personal computing since 1986. already we're seeing, even in that data, the fact that a lot of inequality within American society anyways has been attributed to technological progress and technological use in workplaces. The AI revolution, provided it arrives, of course, and provided it turns up in the ways that all of us are predicting. And of course, that's, you know, that's definitely a subject of debate. Looks like it is going to have a similar effect, but in a much more aggressive fashion, especially when a lot of these technologies are pretty intentionally being created in a way that displaces human labor. You can kind of see the cascading supply and demand effects play out. You can see the cascading effects on, you know, returns to skills and human capital and the ways that that might not go so well for people who have spent their whole lives accumulating skills that can now be completed by algorithms or robots. It creates a lot of, I think, cause for concern and need for policymakers as well as other concerned parties to really keep a close look on what's happening and intervene as needed.
So you talk about the disruption of labor, you know, caused by AI, but we've survived other periods of technological change and labor has adapted more or less over time. Why is AI any different than those other technologies like the personal computer, as you just mentioned, or robotics, for example?
Excellent question, and absolutely the subject of a lot of debate within the field. Some folks would certainly argue that, much like the personal computer, you might see increases in inequality, as we have seen, but not sort of, you know, the wholesale ramifications of job displacement that some of the more pessimistic, you know, predictors are looking at. I think that there's a couple of dynamics at play here that are relevant. The first is the degree to which these technologies are being used to automate versus augment jobs. And that's obviously a really tricky thing to define. Nobody has a precise answer of what exactly that looks like. It's one of those kind of you know it when you see it type heuristics that gets very, very blurry thanks to, you know, one person's augmentation potentially turning into the automation of somebody else's job. I think that sort of dynamic and the degree to which we are building technologies designed to replace human labor versus designed to complement human labor is one aspect of the puzzle that we need to look out for. The second is if we think about what the research incentives look like for, you know, kind of top-tier AI researchers, top-tier machine learning researchers, both in academia as well as in industry. All of the benchmarks that those researchers are rewarded for achieving or beating are what's known as human parity benchmarks. That means, you know, you're being measured based off of how well your technology is able to do the same task as a human, and whether or not you can exceed human capabilities at that task. Almost all of those tasks, well, not almost all, but many of them are things that people presently get paid to be able to complete in workplaces. Yeah. So we've basically created an incentive system that highly encourages automation approaches with very little reward for people tackling the much tougher challenges of how do you expand the productivity frontier by creating complementary technologies that pair with human labor and enable us to do things that are totally different to what we were able to achieve before, either as computers or as people.
So tell me about your work at the Partnership for AI. I mean, how did that partnership come about, and what's the approach you're taking in terms of trying to help mitigate some of those negative impacts of AI on society?
Yeah, so we were founded 6 or 7 years ago at this point by the kind of top researchers at the major AI labs at the time. So, you know, Microsoft, Amazon, at the time, Facebook, now Meta, you know, sort of long list of the major players in the AI space. With their most senior researchers, so, you know, their chief science officer, their chief research officer, et cetera, taking a look at what they saw coming in terms of AI's social impacts. And recognizing that if they were seeing the challenges and the potential social benefits as well as social harms that they could see from their vantage point, you know, within their own companies, that people in similar positions at other companies were likely seeing the same. And that, you know, as they kind of got together and had a number of conversations on these topics, thinking through, you know, the sort of extraordinary potential of these technologies to transform society for the better, there's also widespread recognition amongst that group and the founding members of the PAI that there was a huge potential for downsides and harms as well, and that those harms were almost certainly better understood, better viewed, better articulated by people who weren't necessarily working in kind of major AI labs at the time. And so they, you know, very intentionally joined forces with each other to try and put together an organization that brought in civil society, brought in academia to get a much better understanding of just kind of the broad social impacts of AI, for better and for worse, and bring together the groups needed to be able to say, okay, and if we anticipate that these are the risks of these systems, what does it look like to try and reduce those risks? What should we set as sort of guidelines or norms to ensure that these systems are being used in ways that are socially beneficial, that we're creating socially beneficial systems, and that people who are affected by those systems, which these days is going to, you know, pretty soon is going to be almost everybody in the world, has an opportunity to have some say in the direction that they go.
Well, that's interesting. And so one of the products of that partnership is this recent document that came out, the Guidelines for AI and Shared Prosperity. Tell me a little bit about how that works.
So the Guidelines for AI and Shared Prosperity are the outcome of a roughly three-year-long process with a number of different stakeholders from across the kind of broader understanding of AI's impacts on the economy and on workers participating and helping kind of, you know, set the agenda and shape where it was going. So we had, you know, top-tier economists. You know, I mentioned Jeroen Acemoglu earlier as a member of our steering committee. Also, Anton Korenek, who's doing some fantastic research on AI's economic impacts based at the University of Virginia. Labor organizers, folks who worked in labor policy for the International Labor Organization and for unions, as well as researchers in AI labs thinking through how to create, you know, systems that are useful in workplaces and embraced and sort of welcomed by workers. And so with that kind of setup, you can imagine how there's probably a handful of folks who don't necessarily, you know, come to the table with the exact same set of ideas or same set of perspectives. And so the three-year process was really, you know, starting back in 2020, figuring out what actually do we think the impacts of the technologies realistically are going to be? And not just from a perspective of sort of how many jobs are going to get displaced or anything like that. It sort of is job displacement a realistic outcome that we should anticipate? What kinds of job quality impacts should we be paying attention to when it comes to things like, you know, physical harms to workers, mental stresses and mental harms to workers, loss of autonomy and freedom within kind of a job context, you know, all of these things that, you know, when we look at what counts as a quote unquote good job, we all really appreciate having in place, you know, how is AI shaping potential changes there? And so, you know, kind of over the course of the last 3 years, we went from defining what the issue set could look like to really getting deep and understanding some of those perspectives, you know, talking with workers about how AI use in their jobs is affecting their well-being and what their perspectives on it are, modeling out the supply and demand effects to create a sort of theoretical model to anticipate some of those job displacement outcomes. And move from there to be able to say, okay, if this is what's actually on the table in terms of potential social change, some of which we'd really embrace, right? Who doesn't want more free time and who doesn't want to get rid of, you know, sort of boring tasks in their job, provided they're able to still earn a living that they see fit for themselves and their lifestyle and have the freedom to do as they wish to bring happiness into their own lives? How do we create guidelines for all of the different actors with a role in making that happen to help them understand how to navigate this extremely new moment in artificial intelligence? And so that's what the guidelines are, is, you know, a set of, you know, both a high-level job impact assessment to help companies understand and help AI-using organizations understand what impacts on workers might be, as well as a set of responsible practices to guide the use of these technologies in a way that is ultimately, you know, beneficial for workers and beneficial for labor markets.
So you've studied different aspects of human society over the years. You're a doctor of philosophy with degrees in development studies and anthropology, and you're currently focused on how the economic impact of AI will play out. Do you find yourself drawing from all those degrees, all your knowledge in your work today, like when you're putting these guidelines for AI together, for example?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the anthropology side of my academic training and background is a huge part of, I think, what I bring to this work, thinking about how these different tools interact with the systems that we've the social systems we've created, how people interact with them, and what those kind of patterns and behaviors might look like. Lots of different anthropology angles here, even just from the angle of making sure that we're actually talking to workers to understand what they think about all of this. You know, it's one thing for all of us to be speculating on the behalf of, you know, some occupation or some group of workers, but inevitably they know things much better than anybody from the outside will, right? They're the subject matter experts in their own roles. And so having a chance to kind of spend time with them and get their perspectives and their understanding through their own eyes has been a hugely helpful part of trying to understand this broader set of issues. And of course, you know, all of the talk that I've been offering so far about things like supply and demand effects and complementarity, as your listeners would know, economics is obviously a very important part of this too.
Definitely. So I'm reading this really good book by Brian Christian called The Alignment Problem. I don't know if you've read it or not. It's very interesting, and it's all about how AI is flawed at its core because of the inherent biases of the source information it uses for its own evolution. And so as much as you know, things like the guidelines, your guidelines, can help mitigate some of the, you know, shortcomings of AI, can we ever fix the inherent biases of AI, or is that horse out of the barn at this point?
Ooh, this is a very fun, very sci-fi kind of question. You know, I think what you're describing there would be building some form of superintelligence, because you'd have come up with a system that is more capable of understanding human needs, you know, what would be beneficial for people, than we are ourselves. That, yeah. I think, has its own attendant set of concerns. I've seen some of these movies. They don't play out well for humanity necessarily. But I do think that absolutely, you know, Brian is widely respected in the field with good reason. It is a huge problem to figure out how exactly do you create a universal technology system that has actual values baked into it. Mm. Very different than electricity. You know, electricity has current. that's what's going on there. And you can decide whether you want to use it or you don't want to use it. But you don't have to worry that it might be in conflict with your, you know, personal philosophy or religious beliefs or social values. In this universe, this is exactly what we're trying to figure out. How do you create, is it even possible to create an AI system with universal alignment? I think if it was, somebody might have already figured out how to do it, but I'm glad there's a lot of very smart and motivated people working on exactly that question. And to your previous question about the role of things like social anthropology or sociology in these questions, I think that's going to have to play a really big role in that as well.
And so finally, I mean, what do you think all this means for development? You've worked in development. I mean, you're still involved in development to a certain degree. You know, what does AI mean for all this, not only for the development of countries, but for our own human development? I mean, our own evolution as humans. Where do you think AI is taking us?
Right now, my maybe not super optimistic read is that our governance systems and kind of social systems are not set up well to ensure that these technologies are going to act in, you know, sort of going to be used and going to kind of follow a development trajectory that is in broadly in service of humanity. You know, you've got a situation where a small number of companies in an even smaller number of countries are largely in charge of the development trajectory of these. But the technology itself is capable of hopping borders extremely easily and quickly. What that means is that you've got kind of a narrow, relatively narrow understanding of humanity, relatively narrow swath of humanity, making choices that have a lot of really broad impacts for everybody else. And without sort of systems in place to ensure that those are going to actually create positive or beneficial outcomes. I think there's some really cool experimentation, and I hope it continues to just take off and succeed around sort of how do we actually use AI to help integrate all of those perspectives? Is there a way to take this tool and, you know, use its power to bring in all of the folks who aren't in these conversations, aren't in these rooms? But right now, the sort of way that these technologies are, you know, incentivized and governed, doesn't have a lot of room for thinking through what the impact of call center workers in India and the Philippines looks like when somebody's trying to put together something to lower costs in Salt Lake City. There's, you know, millions of jobs or casualties potentially of that software, despite the fact that that was not the aim of the person who was building it. Trying to think through what that looks like on an international perspective means that we need to start, I think, collaborating internationally and with a lot more intentionality and seriousness of including lower and middle income countries in those conversations than has been true to date. They may not be the places where these technologies are being developed most of the time, although there's some really cool exceptions out there in places like South Africa, Vietnam, et cetera. But they are places that are going to be affected by it. And for us to ensure that that sort of broader set of impacts is something that we are on board with, not just in those sort of small number of countries or small number of companies, but, you know, all 8 billion of us, that's a phenomenal governance challenge. That's not just a technology challenge.
So Stephanie Bell is a senior research scientist at the Partnership for AI. Thanks so much for taking the time.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me, Bruce.
Stephanie Bell led the creation of the Guidelines for AI and Shared Prosperity. You'll find them at partnershiponai.org. And be sure to check out the December edition of the IMF's Finance and Development magazine for a deep dive in how artificial intelligence is changing our economic lives. Go to imf.org/FND. And you can hear more IMF podcasts on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X, what used to be Twitter, at IMF_podcast. I'm Bruce Edwards. Thanks for listening.